Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Joining us today is Grant Babcock. He's the associate editor of libertarianism.org.
Hello.
Today we're going to talk about natural rights and then specifically how they relate to radical libertarianism. What are natural rights?
Well, so two parts, right? There's the rights part and the natural part. So let's start with the rights part. A right basically is there are certain things which other people can't do to you and you can't do to other people by virtue of your possessing moral agency and personhood, right? So if we think that it's wrong for me to reach across the table and stab Trevor in the chest with my pen, and that the reason that's wrong is because it's disrespectful to Trevor's dignity as a moral agent, right? Because there are things that I could reach across and stab with my pen, like a stuffed animal or maybe a fish, depending.
Both of those would be pretty creepy to do, though.
Right.
Or if a fish was at the table, that'd be. But
yeah.
Or if you just stabbed a stuffed animal here, that would be pretty strange. But continue.
Right. And we think that would be wrong, like by, again, by virtue of something about Trevor, and that he's a moral agent, that he's a person, and I use person in the ethical sense, right, of the word person. So then, what makes a right a natural right? Well, that would be probably the easiest way to describe it would be to contrast it with something like a civil right. So a civil right would be something like the right to vote. It only makes sense to talk about the right to vote in the context of a democracy where we have privileges, you know, that are contingent on that particular political system.
And them setting up polling places, balloting places.
Right, right.
There's a lot of things that are required for voting.
Or a right to trial by jury, for example. And a natural right, in contrast, is it's a pre-political type of right. So it's the sort of thing where even if there were no polling places, even if the halls of Congress were empty, it would still be wrong for me to steal Trevor's coffee mug.
But the voting would be irrelevant.
Right.
Is it?
Yeah.
So it's pre-political, but it's also, just to clarify, post-political, in the sense that these rights exist before government and would exist without government, but the argument is they also continue to exist even if there is a government.
Correct. The one wrinkle with that is that sometimes social contract theorists will talk about us bargaining away certain natural rights in a social contract. I might have a right to basically be a vigilante, right? So if I think I've been injured by Trevor, I have the right to avenge myself upon him, or to, you know, if he stole my coffee mug, I could go and take it back myself. Whereas some social contracts theorists would say when you enter into political society, you give up that natural right, and in exchange you get the political right to, you know, be part of the justice system.
Now, either one of those, we could talk, and we have talked on Free Thoughts before about whether social contract theory is legitimate or all those things.
Yeah.
But if you're in a social contract system, as America theoretically is at least, or in a state of anarchy that respects rights all the time and have not been bargained away. But in both those, we're still talking about some sort of rights-based theory of either government legitimacy or maybe non-legitimacy of government, both based in rights, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And that means – and that, of course, is our tradition. And it also seems to me that there aren't many people – and you know the literature better than I do, but who just – don't think rights exist.
Oh, well, there's plenty of people like that, right? So anyone who is a utilitarian, right?
I mean, yeah, if you're like a strict utilitarian, but those are pretty rare.
Well,
maybe not in the academy.
Right. So that's the thing is I'm definitely thinking in terms of the academy, because if we're talking about the moral sense that your average human being on the street has, that's really – it's not systematized or formalized in any way. So it wouldn't really make sense to say this guy, you know, believes in rights and consistently and this guy doesn't, right? It's more of – it's going to be a hodgepodge.
Do these rights So the ones that you described are you can't do certain things to Trevor. And I wonder just how many times, and this is going to be episode 202, there's been hypothetical violence directed at Trevor. It seems to go that way more than any other. He's just
more punchable.
I guess I have the Ted Cruz punchable face.
Yes.
These rights are – Trevor has rights by nature of his humanity that are then act as prohibitions, limits on what you're allowed to do.
Right.
So in Nozick's term, they're side constraints.
Right. Let's go on side constraints for a minute. So the idea is that I have a sort of sphere of independent action wherein I get to make decisions about how things go, right? And that – well, where's the border to that? Well, the border to that is there are things outside my legitimate realm of control, right? So
is that your rights? Is that what you're saying?
Right. So and
my right to swing my fist ends at your face.
Yeah. See, that's almost a little question beggy, right? Let's go back to me stabbing you. Right.
Please, so let's do.
Yeah.
Aaron's smiling over there.
It can't come up enough.
Yes.
So let's say I have a kitchen knife. Right. There are lots of things that I get to do with that kitchen knife. Right. I get to prepare a steak with it. I can sharpen it. I can destroy it. Melt it down. All these things. Right. I get to decide what happens about it. The reason that I can't decide that what happens to the knife is that it goes into your chest is because now I'm not making decisions just about the knife anymore. Right. I'm also making decisions about your chest and its structural cohesion.
Does this then mean that natural rights are always and only negative rights, as it's called? So they're prohibitions on what you can do to other people or other people. It's my rights are things that people may not do to me, as opposed to positive rights, which are more like I have an expectation that things – I will receive certain things or things will be done for me.
Like there has to be some economic production which is then so it sort of depends on what part of the natural rights tradition you're talking about, right? And it also depends on if you're talking about whether it is an enforceable thing or not. So you could argue and libertarians have argued that children have a right to food and shelter from their parents or guardians, right? And that would be an example of a right that they have by virtue of being what they are that is pre-political, but it's probably a positive right. The main line of the liberal tradition, going back into the Enlightenment and continuing down to us three sitting around the table right now, tends to think that at least when it comes to adults, we're talking about negative rights as being the ones relevant to political questions of enforceability.
Libertarians are often associated with rights theory. I think if anyone has a kind of popular conception of libertarianism, it has to do with these very strong assertions of rights. Is that the right conception of libertarianism in your view?
In my view, yes. I think that the rights conception is the correct one, but it's not the only way libertarians think about ethics.
This is where we can plug. Grant and I are the co-editors of Arguments for Liberty, which you can download for free at libertarianism.org, which presents 9 different arguments, only one of which is grounded in a strict natural rights conception.
Yeah, maybe 2, depending on how you count Kant. Ugh.
count Kant? Is that what we just said?
I tried to.
Okay, all right. So what sort of questions in this sense, getting into the heart of your essay, if you have a robust respect for rights, it gets you to a properly liberal order is in your conception, and they're fairly absolutist. Would that be correct the way you view it?
Right. I think that this idea of absolutism is sort of baked into the idea of a right. It's a bright line. It's a line in the sand. It's a this far, no further kind of way of thinking about morality. So that gets in sort of directly to the question of does that imply radicalism?
What do you mean by radicalism? So what is radical libertarianism?
Right. I mean, I wish someone would tell me in some sense, but we can try. The word radical is thrown around a lot of different ways. In some uses, it's just a pejorative, right? It means unserious and sort of immature and concerned with extremism for its own sake. I think that's nibbling around the edges of something that's almost correct, right? Which is that radicalism is a relative thing. It's relative to some kind of center, which is in this context, it would be like the status quo, right? So like how different are my views about how the political order should be compared to how it is? And the bigger that gap is, the more radical I am.
And so you're okay. That's why you're okay with being called radical in this regard,
right? Yeah. Because I'm an anarchist, as you know, you both know, and I guess the audience now does.
So is radicalism then synonymous with anarchism or radical libertarianism, or can you be a radical libertarian, or I guess a natural rights libertarian, without taking that all the way to the abolition of the state?
So I think there's a distinction to be made here, and I'm going to draw on an essay by Murray Rothbard called "Do You Hate the State?" And he says, when he says radical, right, he means radical in the sense of being in total root and branch opposition to the existing political system and to the state itself. Radical in the sense of having integrated intellectual opposition to the state with a gut hatred of its pervasive and organized system of crime and injustice. Radical in the sense of a deep commitment to the spirit of liberty in any statism that integrates reason and emotion, heart and soul. And then he goes on and he gives examples of anarchists who he thinks are not radical and minimal state type libertarians who he thinks are radical. So his sort of paradigm case for a anarchist libertarian who he doesn't think is radical is David Friedman, who wrote The Machinery of Freedom around the same time as his book For a New Liberty came out. And David Friedman's book is all about the utilitarian case for libertarian anarchism, like the idea that, you know, life will be better and more enjoyable and we'll all be wealthier and happier if we get rid of the state. Now, in that book, Friedman takes care to say, look, I'm not dismissing rights out of hand, but I think that if, you know, rhetorically speaking, we're trying to convince somebody that it makes sense to make consequentialist utilitarian type arguments. Rothbard doesn't necessarily think he's super serious about that, but that might be a fault of Rothbard rather than Friedman.
So who would be a radical minarchist or minimal state?
Well, he gives a great list actually, right? He says, our classical liberal forebears who were genuinely radical, who hated statism in the states of their day with a beautifully integrated passion, the Levellers, Patrick Henry, Tom Paine, Joseph Priestley, the Jacksonians, Richard Cobden, and on, right? And he says, Tom Paine's radical hatred of the state and statism was and is far more important to the cause of liberty than the fact that he never crossed the divide between laissez-faire and anarchism.
So that gets us – I'm trying to parse this out in my head that we're talking about absolutism and rights, and you sort of – you said they're inherently absolutist. And one of the things – you think you wrote this essay in response to an essay by our former colleague Brink Lindsey, who was criticizing natural rights theory. And the main source of his criticism was basically the absolutism of these rights, claiming to like either A, going too far because of the perception of that, or they're just going too far, or and B, because they don't, the absolutism of the rights doesn't solve many questions. But so if we're going to say these rights are absolute, we have these questions about that always come up, and we've talked about, I think, 190 episodes ago with Matt Zwolinski, or we talked about shining laser pointers on your house and pollution and minor little, you know, touching you for a second. And
or going back to the knife and Trevor example, because again,
that too,
like if he's unconscious and, you know, he's choking and you need to cut a hole in his throat,
right,
to
right.
So on one level, you know, libertarians will say what many people think are quote unquote crazy things by just saying, yes, if you shine a laser pointer on my door, you are violating my rights. Rights are absolute.
Yeah.
So how do you respond to those kind of characterizations?
This is sort of hard to talk about generally, so I'll try to get more concrete with the laser pointer, right? Like, yeah, if you're shining a laser pointer on my house and I want you to stop doing that, I should be able to ask you to stop doing that and you should comply, right?
But does that – so is that I guess going to that. So does it limit your ability to retaliate, or do rights theory itself tell you how you can react to someone's violations of your rights, or do you need something else?
Right. Okay. I see where you're going with this now. Basically, all rights tell you is where the line is. It doesn't necessarily tell you what an appropriate response is, right? You could say, I believe absolutely in natural rights, but then also have some kind of theory of proportionality, right? Now, Rothbard famously is not really big on this. And actually, I think Locke isn't either, right? He says if someone is trespassing, then that means that, well, they might, you know, if they're willing to do that, then as far as you know, they're willing to kill you, so you can kill them right back.
To put this another way, there's the argument that, you know, if we took these, if rights are absolute, and so to take your laser pointer example, like so someone shining it on your house, it's, you know, at best or at most a vanishingly small harm to your property, but you can tell them not to and they should comply. That gets us into – was it Zelensky who wrote the essay on pollution?
Pollution, yeah, that could shut down industry.
Yeah, that if we took that seriously and took it to its natural conclusions, we wouldn't be allowed to have industry.
Which Brink
raises
in his essay.
We wouldn't be allowed to drive cars. We wouldn't be allowed to do anything because the pollution or the noise or whatever else would be infringing on people's rights, which would seem to, you know, cast us into pretty impoverished lives. So is getting out of that? Do you bite the bullet on that and say, yes, well, if we're going to just respect everyone's rights, we would have to live as hermits? Or do you say, well, the rights, those aren't really rights violations, like the rights are more flexible than that? Or do you say those are such de minimis harms that we just, it's like unreasonable to not put up with them. Like, yes, I'm violating your rights, but it's so small that if you get mad and try to stop me, you're overreacting.
A few things. So Rothbard famously says, like, no, like smokestacks are aggression. You know, polluting rivers with your industrial runoff is aggression, and that, you know, the people who then are harmed by, you know, breathing bad air and drinking bad water have cause of action against you, right? He thinks in a sort of, there's some path dependency here, right? Where we live in a world where the state has basically issued out all these permits saying you're allowed to emit this much, you know, toxic stuff, and you're allowed to emit this much toxic stuff, and other people can't, right? And then we've built up this industrial society on that basis. But he's imagining a sort of a different path where the law took a different tack on that and said, you know, pretty strongly no, right? So many of these questions of practicality, right, sort of boil down to, I can't imagine a business model that successfully does X. Therefore, X is impossible. Therefore, your demand for, you know, radical libertarianism is kaput. I'm sort of uncompelled by that sort of thing, and part of it is I very seldom see a good faith attempt to even try to think of how it might work. A great example of this is when Ludwig von Mises is writing, I think it's in one of the later editions to Human Action that came out after Rothbard had sort of started talking about anarchism. Mises is talking about how, well, you know, capitalism and freedom and all these things are contingent upon sort of a society that has the rule of law and all these things. So therefore, to talk about the market producing legal services like courts and police and that sort of thing is a category error. And, you know, the whole anarchist project is just doesn't get off the ground. I think that's sort of fairly obviously just a failure of imagination, right? About and a very like excessively narrow view of like what markets are and the applicability of even Mises' own thinking about human action, right?
So getting into some of the criticisms that Brink has made about the natural rights theory, but one of them is that the need more than rights, and we kind of touched on it, and so maybe I already know your answer, but we can get back into it, which is we need more than rights to answer some questions that the legal system answers without rights. And if libertarians are going to sort of say, no, rights sort of solve the problems of the world, when he sort of says we don't need politics, then we're ignoring all these basic facts. So yes, you have a right to property and you can homestead it, but how high above your property do you own? And your right doesn't answer it. Or how do you abandon your property? How long do you have to let it go until you abandon it? Or like sort of in an adverse possession sense, all these questions are not answered by rights. So therefore, it seems that rights don't get us too far. There's a lot of play in the joints, and it could be a rights respecting world generally, but also not very libertarian.
Right. I think that's sort of confused on several levels. The first is it's mischaracterizing like what the work that rights are doing when you're thinking about a libertarian or even a non-libertarian political order. Right. Like these are side constraints. It doesn't tell us anything about, you know, what we do inside the edges of the canvas, right? And indeed, there will be like multiple possibilities that are compatible with rights thinking. One of my favorite things, Trevor, that we've talked about in the past is sort of the rituals and signifiers that different societies have used to determine what counts as a transfer of property. Where like way back in medieval England, if I wanted to buy Aaron's acre of land, we actually both had to go out there. Aaron had to pick up some dirt off the ground and put it in my hand. And
the
only
livery of season,
right?
Yes.
Only then was the deal sealed, right? This is one of the few concepts actually where I think Hans Hoppe's characterization is interesting and helpful, where he talks about the intersubjectively determinable boundaries, right, which are sort of necessarily going to be socially contingent, right? There's nothing eternal about going to a land and handing dirt to each other, right? There could be other like sufficient ways of cashing out what a property system and land looks like. And then there are questions which don't really have anything to do with rights at all, like which side of the road should everyone drive on, right? Hayek talks about this sort of thing a lot when he talks about the law, about there needs to be a uniform convention, but it doesn't really matter much one way or the other what it's about. And like in that case, rights aren't going to drill down, nor are they trying to.
So does that mean that we're okay with these legal? So in we talk about again, I say adverse possession or regulations that infringe upon your property of certain, like, so you can't build buildings super high to obstruct airplanes, or you don't own all the way to the sky, or you would own airplanes as they flew over your house. These all seem absurd, but if you took rights theory to the extreme, maybe that's the case. And if we're going to give a concession to, well, you know, socially ordering helps and it matters in the situation, so therefore we can concede that we're going to work in politics to some degree insofar as we're negotiating the terms of what the limits of these rights are, as long as we're still keeping honest about protecting the rights themselves, that we can play in the joints.
This politics thing, right, seems to me it's trying to aim at characterizing anyone who says like rights are a serious thing we need to consider. It's trying to say that thereby they're like dodging the hard work of cashing out all these details, and which are important, right, to have a functioning society. That strikes me as sort of silly. There's nothing to do with rights or radicalism that is apolitical in that, like the fact that I think that there is a right or a wrong answer to a certain question, or even multiple right and multiple wrong answers to a certain question, nothing about that lets me escape politics, right? I still have to do the work of persuasion and the work of bargaining, if you like, right?
I think there's also in that critique, there's an equivocation on the definition of politics.
Yeah.
Because in those questions that need to be answered, that rights can't answer, that we have to do the rough and tumble of persuasion and compromise and all of that, those would be present even in an anarchist society, right? In a society, like, because it's a society, and when you're in a society, you have to interact with your fellow human beings, and you have to figure out how to live together and how to live in beneficial ways. And so, if politics simply is, it seems like when, you know, when the critique is, well, this natural rights thing is like a, you know, an unjustified rejection of politics, like you think you can escape it. Well, no, if that's what we mean by politics, which is simply kind of social persuasion and social interaction and living together in a society, then that politics is very much a part of a strict natural rights and even anarchist society.
Right.
But the equivocation comes in sliding over to politics necessarily means politics of the state.
Right.
It means, you know, solving like not just the act of trying to figure those questions out, but the act of figuring those questions out via the mechanisms of government as an enforcement tool, as a system of institutions. And it seems to me, and so the thought is like there's almost a false dilemma, I think, that's being articulated, which is, look, if you, you know, if you say you're rejecting politics, then really what you're doing is rejecting – you're rejecting the whole thing. So if I say, no, I'm realistic and think we need to have politics, that means necessarily we need the institutions of a liberal order, the state, the coercive force of laws,
right,
and all of that.
Right.
And so to say – and so we can say like, look, it would be unreasonable to reject politics. And so then therefore if you reject government politics, you're being unreasonable, whereas you can simply instead say, no, what I'm doing is rejecting the necessity of these particular institutions as an enforcement mechanism for the political, and instead I'm going to embrace the political as a different non-governmental system.
It reminds me of the cattle farmers of Shasta County, California, as one is usually reminded in times like these. This is a book by Robert Ellickson called Order Without Law, where he analyzes the way cattle farming is done in this relatively rural part of California, where essentially they've come up with a bunch of rules that are trying to deal with the kind of questions, the practical, so to speak, questions we're talking about cattle, and when they go out, they let them into the field in the mountains when they're during the winter, and then they bring them back in, and sometimes they trample on other people's property, and sometimes they die, or like, or there's a conflict of different sorts, and they've developed a bunch of rules that you could call political. They've done it through just long-term social interaction, and eventually they were ignoring the laws of California that California told them, no, these are actually the laws about who has the loss and who is going to have to pay in these situations. They just ignored them and used their own rules. In that situation, I think it goes to what Aaron was saying, is that they didn't – they figured out these inherently difficult questions. They figured out solutions, at least workable for right now, solutions to these questions through methods that are not just endorsing the political in the way that you described it.
Right. The other book I'd want to point out here is Eleanor Ostrom's work about governing the commons is the title, and it's about governing the commons, right? How do communities solve tragedy of the commons style problems without recourse to a monopoly like punishing state?
So if we're getting into what a lot of the criticisms here that I think Brink was putting on natural rights libertarianism, and of course Brink has been on the show before and he's always welcome back, but the criticisms, a lot of them are about strategy, which is something we talk about on the show a lot anyway, whether or not we're going, it's best to, you know, proceed from a radical standpoint or to work in the halls of government. It's something libertarians talk about all the time. But one of the things that Brink argues is that, you know, from a standpoint of the way the politics is in this country, and that we're broadly liberal, and that if we're not participating in that discussion and that we're saying we have all these solutions that we don't even need to get involved in those politics, then it's not going to be strategically good for libertarians to stay out of those and just – and to say that things that people really like and really care about possibly, such as the welfare state and regulations on safety and health and things like this, that they're just not acceptable and we won't come and talk to you. We won't come and talk to your political people or try to persuade it until you just get rid of that entire thing, the welfare state or whatever, that's just absolutely unreasonable and a good way to guarantee the libertarians won't ever positively affect anything.
Well, so there's two things going on there, right? One is that I think that Brink thinks that the welfare state is like probably a good idea, at least within certain limits, right? And or cashed out in a certain way. And then the second question is, Well, suppose then that the libertarian position is that the welfare state's bad, which I think the welfare state's bad and we shouldn't have one. I mean, we shouldn't have the rest of the state either, but that's a discussion for later. It strikes me as odd to say that, well, we can make progress on this thing if we just pretend that, you know, we agree with them on all this other stuff, right? And that talking about the welfare state being bad is preventing us from, you know, whatever the laundry list of things it is, like criminal justice reform or the tax code or any of these other issues, right? I don't think politics really works that way, where you know, I mean, I guess someone could have a view that's like so repugnant, like they're a, like a white supremacist or something, that they become sort of radioactive and you can't work with them on anything. But my feeling is, if you want to be respected in serious conversations about politics, that look, you just say like, this is what I believe, and this is like the strongest good faith argument I can make for that, right? And that doesn't mean you can't then make comparative statements. Right. You know, I could say, look, I don't think the government should be involved in education at all, but a voucher system might be better than universal public schooling. Right. Now, Murray Rothbard famously thought the opposite. Right. He thought that vouchers were a step away from the libertarian ideal because you had this functioning private system that was doing things outside the state without very much state oversight or intervention, and that by letting the vouchers in, you're letting in state money and therefore state control, right? And you're basically co-opting the private schools into the public ones.
That's a strategy discussion, though.
Right, right. And well, and it's also it goes to show that you can, even if you're both radicals, you might disagree about incremental steps, right? Or like whether a step is in the right direction and whether it's good or bad, you know, whether it's a small step or a big step.
I think there's also another false dilemma happening here, and another interesting thing happening in this argument that because moderation is maybe more effective in getting policy stuff done in Washington, whether it's, you know, easier to get your foot in the door if you are behaving in a moderate fashion, or
you
people
mean
are
moderate more, relatively.
Moderate, right? Relatively.
Yeah. And I take issue even with that premise, actually.
But
right?
Let's just, yeah, you know, just accept for the sake of argument that, you know, if you are espousing really radical absolute positions, you're not going to be listened to.
Yeah.
Let's just say.
But that's getting the causation backwards, right?
No, but let me just, because okay, I think we'll bracket that issue, because I think that okay, there's something else going on here, which is, so the move though that seems to be going on is to say, because it is, so we could say like, look, you can be like natural rights radicalism might be right, correct, the truth in terms of the way that we should look morally at our interaction with other people, with the government, but to always rhetorically go to it might be a failure. And so therefore, we should moderate our tone and moderate what we're saying in order to advance in that direction. That's an argument. But it seems like there's another version of the argument that then takes it like retroactively to say, and because of that, natural rights itself must be wrong. Like that, because moderation is tactically better, the underlying motive of natural rights can't be like, it's ontologically incorrect.
And that doesn't follow from.
Right. And I think that where that gets us is you can run into a serious problem where, so to analogize this to say the abolition debate, okay? So you might make an argument that, so you could say, slavery is absolutely wrong. It's about as repugnant and immoral an act as anyone can engage in. This is a bright line. There's no nuance here, like end of story. But if we are going to end widespread slavery, simply taking up arms and killing slave owners might not do it as quickly and effectively as, say, operating at the legislative level and trying to persuade the slave owner, like
Right. Well, slave owning, not, you know, not to conflate radicalism with advocating violence. Also.
Sure. But so you might say like that's a more effective way to get it done faster and safer. Okay. And so therefore you should temper your rhetoric slightly when trying to advance this cause.
Yeah. Aaron put scare quotes around that because yes. By temper his rhetoric, he means hide the ball.
But right? The problem I think is when you then – like well, I think what's going on here on this natural rights argument is saying then something along the lines of not only that what that actually means is that being an absolutist on the issue of slavery itself is wrong. That you know you should take a moderate position on slavery and on the rightness or wrongness of slavery in order to have your rhetoric match your principles.
Yeah.
But that seems to me like there's no reason to betray your principles simply because you think a different style of rhetoric is going to be more effective.
Well, let's think about it this way for a minute. Suppose that every libertarian who is more radical than Gary Johnson stops saying anything more or advocating anything more radical than Gary Johnson. What is the effect of this? The effect of this is that Gary Johnson is now the most radical libertarian, right?
You think that would be bad for libertarianism? Yeah.
I mean I think so, and I think it would be tactically bad, right? Because you know, as much as I get upset when more moderate libertarians point to the radical libertarians and say, look, I'm not that guy. I may be a little nuts, but I'm not Grant Babcock, right? So
I may have done that before. No.
So this idea that we need to, you know, the radicals should just be quiet, right? And then everything, all of a sudden, the you know the gates of power will open up to Gary Johnson, and he'll be able to, you know, legalize weed and whatever other incremental gain it is, right? I think that's sort of wrongheaded. Like, it's not that you know the radicals being there is preventing that, right? So it's true though that the U.S. political system is set up where decisions are made like by moderates at the margin, right? But that doesn't mean that becoming more moderate and closer to the margin makes you more influential, right? Like if we want to move, you know, where the median voter is, right? You don't do that by moving yourself closer to the existing median because the median has changed, right? It also seems
somewhat implausible that to say like the reason that Gary Johnson's policies, say, are not accepted by the American public or by lawmakers is because there are people more radical than Gary Johnson. I mean that seems like an odd argument when in fact the reason that Gary Johnson's policies are not more popular among American voters and lawmakers is because American voters and lawmakers are not fans of Gary Johnson's policies.
Right. No one says, for example, that like Hillary Clinton is unelectable because the Socialist Workers Party exists.
And that's an interesting point because the radicalism that libertarians get accused of is something that often irks me because you know, we're the kind of people if you go on a TV show and you're advocating a principle. And we talked about this. I think it's in the Jamie White episode, the politics in New Zealand episode, although it might have been conversations outside of that episode. So I apologize if you went to – but we discussed this. He was talking about consensual sexual relationships, like advocating consensual sexual relationships among adults in New Zealand. And he goes on TV and the first thing the person asks him is incest. Defend it, which is an interesting. I mean, it's an interesting way of flipping it to us and making us defend. And maybe it's the result of defending a rights perspective is that people want to take you to the extreme and make you defend it.
Yeah. But it's weird.
But you would never do this. Like again, it was like, okay, you believe in banning some consensual sexual relationships, and then the person comes on TV and you say, banning making out in a car on Lover's Lane. Defend that, you know, and making them defend something extreme, although that might have been actually illegal at some point. But nevertheless,
this goes to there's an interesting unidirectionality to radicalism. So Grant has effectively defined radicalism as there's a baseline, there's the status quo, and the further you are from it, the more radical you are. But the way that radical gets used here and the way that radical gets used in Washington, it's only really something that gets applied if you move in one direction away from the status quo. So if you are advocating the state not doing things that it's currently doing, doing fewer things, ultimately if you're an anarchist doing nothing, then that's the spectrum that you're a radical. But if you're on the other side of it and you – like in the banning making out in cars, if you are just as far from the status quo but you're instead advocating the state do a whole lot more, well, you might – you would say like, well, no, you got the economics wrong, or you have – you know, you haven't – this cause you haven't figured out. But we don't say like, well, that's just kind of silly radicalism to think that we should have single-payer health care.
Even you're though an insane monster.
Just as far from the status quo as saying we should have, you know, markets in healthcare. Only one gets, and I think that's because there's this, it still is just in the Washington culture, and I think this is true even in the, I mean, just in the broader culture, that it, there's something, it's just to be opposed to the state doing things is simply uncouth. You know, it's the same as that really silly thing you see from journalists all the time where they'll say like, this was the least productive Congress in, you know, 10 years because they didn't pass very many laws. Like the way that we measure the productivity of a government is simply by the number of laws it puts on the books, not the quality of the laws
and the way we measure the greatness of presidents is by how many people they kill.
Yeah, how many wars they fought. But I'm on the radical point too. I think it's important to point out when you do use a robust conception of natural rights, going back to this question about radicalism, you can be ahead of the curve, and I always put this out very, you know, especially gay marriage and especially marijuana legalization and drug legalization. That stuff was crazy, and for those libertarians who, you know, believe that we have to concede to the popular opinion of the middle and not advocate anything too extreme, if that's the actual position, although I'm not sure that's the actual position, I think the actual position is that they think some things are more important rights than other things. But if it's all about rhetoric, you say, so in 1985, we shouldn't have been talking about legalizing marijuana because we look like the crazy people on the block who were advocating something that was totally insane and therefore people weren't going to listen to us. And now, of course, we have it. It's a pretty popular position. Same with gay marriage. And one of the big virtues of that is, you know, when you're advocating a natural rights conception of something like consensual sexual relationships, is that we never needed to have the discovery of a gay gene or the proof that homosexuality doesn't cause social harm. These kind of things where people say, we want to legalize homosexuality because we have a study that says it's not harmful to raise children for gay couples, or we want to legalize because we found a gay gene. We didn't need a gay gene to say, no, it's not definitionally a crime because of a theory of natural rights. If you have to find a gay gene to protect consensual sexual activity, then there better be a BDSM gene or for them to protect their activities. No, that's not how you think about it. It's consensual activity. And is that radical? Absolutely. In 1973, which was when the American Psychological Association took homosexuality off of being a mental illness.
Right. We've been sort of ragging on this idea that radicalism is bad, and I sort of want to be clear that there is a sense in which that's true. Like there's a kernel of truth, which is that being abrasive and extreme for its own sake is probably a bad thing. There's a 1978 essay by Michael Cloud called "The Late Great Libertarian Macho Flash," and it's sort of a memoir.
Is this on libertarianism.org?
It is not, but maybe it should be. It's sort of a memoir of his experiences tabling, right? Which is a thing that you used to do.
You still do that,
yeah?
They still do that.
I did it in undergrad, but it's less prevalent now than maybe hanging out on Facebook all the time. But basically, he would observe, and you know, he included himself in this, people delighting in offending the sensibilities of people less radical than them, right? Where someone would say, come up to them, and rather than they ask some policy question, you know, and it wouldn't even be something like unfair, like you think toddlers should have tanks, right? Which sure, why not? recreational nukes for all, but It would be like – it would be something like, oh, you think we shouldn't have Social Security, right?
And tanks, by the way, are probably far safer in the hands of toddlers than in adults.
Yeah.
Because the toddler's not going to be able to do much with it, whereas the adult has the ability malice.
Speaking of toddlers with tanks, Donald Trump does have tanks currently, so.
Yeah. And nukes.
And nukes.
Whether or not they're recreational is up in the air.
Yes.
Right. But they would ask even these like reasonable questions about, you know, what about Social Security, right? And then they would come out like guns blazing, like, you want to enslave me by, you know, taking my hours of labor through the income tax and, right? And
just the extreme posturing, yes.
Right. And that sort of thing is entirely self-serving, right? There's no attempt there being made at persuasion. There's no attempt to say, here's the best case I can come up with for, you know, why it's true, you know, in a level-headed, temperate way that, you know, we shouldn't have Social Security, right? It's done because it makes you feel good. It makes you feel like I'm this cool outsider who's like better than everyone, right?
So I think that the core idea here that we keep coming back to then is and it applies to this natural rights discussion, but it's much broader than that, is that there's a difference between that principle and rhetoric are not the same thing, and that changing rhetoric or saying that the rhetorical style you're using is not effective, is not good, is caustic, is whatever else, is driving people away, is not itself a critique of your underlying moral principles.
Right. Well, and I think that it's also saying like it's not just about rhetoric, right? It's saying that like, look, this principle is not conducive to winning, therefore we should abandon it, as though winning is the goal and not the principle, right? This is one of the things that drive me insane about the whole Trump thing, right? Where people are saying, look, you know, the Libertarian Party is never going to win. Rand Paul is never going to win. Take whatever, you know. So what libertarians should do is, you know, find someone who is going to win and support that person, which – That's insane.
Which is exactly the, I mean, if there's an ideology to the Trump voters, it's that. It's like that the only thing that matters is winning in this weirdly defined, you know, I mean, I think that for a lot of Trump voters, that's the core base. It's that, you know, winning is simply making the people we disagree with mad. Like that's it. And so as long as we're making them mad, whatever it is, like there's no, it's winning divorced from principle.
Right.
Entirely.
Right. Because the whole reason you want to win is because you have this principle.
Because
you
want to enact
important.
The principle or, right. or move in the right direction towards
right. So,
it.
So if we're then talking about, you know, libertarians who genuinely think that the welfare state is unconscionable, right, should stop thinking that because it won't win, right? That's like, I don't care, right?
Well, yeah, but that's not, that's not the point so much. I think that the really interesting thing that we've hit on in this conversation, which I mean, I think it's sort of implicit in a lot of the writings that are – I mean, really, it's been a debate in libertarianism for a long time before it was recently a debate on the website, but that there are some people who think that some rights are more important than other rights or they should be moderated in certain ways. So the question about and I might be one of these people, like free speech rights, you know, consensual sexual activity. I'm trying to think of what else is listed in your essay here. Different types of freedom of association, political involvement, things like this. Be pretty absolutist on those things. But then when it comes to something like, you know, we're going to take 10% of your income to help people out who are poor, it's like that's – yes, and that's okay. Though that's less offensive to me because I think that these economic rights, these rights of property are less absolute than I would argue that free speech rights are, for example. Now, it's the hard part would be justifying that because a lot of things that are criticized about absolute rights, as you point out in your essay, you say the absolute rights don't solve all these questions. What about when you have certain dangers or things that don't come up? Well, free speech has all these problems too. And you say we have freedom and we have security and you say, okay, well, what about trading secrets or what about giving aid and comfort to the enemy? What about passing out draft dodging literature on World War I? We still have to make these decisions or we can just be absolutist and say yes and you can also yell fire in a crowded theater.
Right. So there's a few things going on here, some of which are sort of technical, and I may just spout out some citations and then leave it at that. So rights thinking is I think it's Nozick who says rights are trumps, right? The idea is if I have a rights claim and you have something that is not a rights claim, my claim wins, right? So if I own this styrofoam cup, which I am brandishing in the air, and you do not own it, but you want it for some reason, like maybe I need that styrofoam cup to live or something. Like what I don't know what your story is, but if I have a right of ownership over the cup, that trumps your claim, right? So there's this question of, okay, can rights conflict, right? And that's a subject of some debate in the literature on rights. There's sort of a few ways you can go, right? If you have a situation where there's multiple sort of types of right, then maybe you're running into these balancing issues. On the other hand, if there's sort of like one overarching thing, and then everything else sort of follows from that, right? Or as an instance of, then sort of from the beginning, you're set up not to have these conflicts. So if I describe my right to free speech as a ownership right, an ownership of my body, an ownership over this paper and this pen, an ownership over a printing press, right? An ownership over a movie theater, right? Now there's no longer a question of can my right to speech conflict with your right to some other thing, right? Because it's all we're talking in the same terms, right? And that's sort of the tack Rothbard takes. The stuff to read on this about the compossibility is the word that is used, right? In the literature, the compossibility of rights. Can two rights exist at the same time without conflicting? Are they possible together? Compossible. And
Hillel Steiner's Essay on Rights, is that what you're going to say?
Well, I was going to start there, right?
That book is very expensive and almost impossible to find. I believe that we can put a link up to Tom Palmer's kind of summation of it.
Yeah, well, I was thinking specifically there's an essay in that book, I think, called The Structure of a Set of Compossible Rights.
It could be. It's just very yeah. – I've been looking for that book recently.
Okay.
And it's like $600.
Well, okay. Well, so if you're a college student with access to JSTOR, you can get it through there, which is how I got my copy of the essay. The other one is Alan Gaworth, The Basis and Content of Human Rights. And then Cato's own Roger Pilon, Ordering Rights Consistently. And Roger's project in that work is he was studying under Gaworth, and he took Gaworth's framework and said, like, you're almost there, but the answer you're looking for is libertarian conception of rights and how they work. And I think he argues it fairly compellingly.
I wanted to just make a quick point about radicalism. So this could be rights radicalism. It could be libertarian radicalism. It needn't be libertarian anarchist radicalism, but anything where you're pushing – you're sufficiently far from the status quo to be radical. I think that the rejection – one of the problems with the rejection of that on its face of just saying, well, you shouldn't be a radical, which underlies a lot of the critiques of the kind of natural rights radicalism that Grant that you write about is that it's to some extent it's ahistorical. That you go back and you look at the history of political progress, that the changes that made the world a significantly better, freer, happier place, they're not coming from people who wanted to tinker around the middle. They may have been enacted in some cases by that, but they're driven by radicals, by people who were thinking way ahead of their time, by people who were making forceful arguments. You read these texts and they're the texts that today resonate with us, where you read them and you can say like, this person, you know, maybe they're not ultimately as radical as I am, but these people were really on to something, had incredibly important stuff to say, and their ideas changed the world. You never say, well, I wish they had just tamped it down a bit. I wish that they hadn't advocated so much radical stuff. I wish that they had stuck more to tinkering around the margins. You say instead, no, I wish if anything that they had been louder and that more people had listened to them and that their radicalism had spread faster and further than it had. And so I think that if we see radicalism now as, you know, like the art of the impossible, you know, like why bother with it? We're only going to tinker around the edges. That's ahistorical in the sense that it's like this is not it. There is absolutely no reason to believe, none to believe now that we have reached the pinnacle of government institutions, that we've reached the pinnacle of human achievement, that we've reached the pinnacle of human freedom, that the world as it is now is the best that we can get. That would be as absurd as thinking that science today has figured everything out and there will be no more progress. And so if we reject the very idea of radicalism, we reject the people who are making these large claims, we will halt progress. And so maybe the radicals are wrong. Maybe some of them are wrong or maybe some of them are right. But in retrospect, future generations will look back on us if we embrace that path and say, boy, I wish those people had been a little more radical.
On that point, Aaron, there's this this tendency that we see sometimes with libertarians to think that the liberal tradition, the classical liberal tradition, like starts with John Locke and ends with Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and that ever since then we've just sort of been coasting, right? And that we reached the full implications of the Enlightenment revolution in thinking about man's place in the political order. But there are thinkers in the liberal tradition like Murray Rothbard, like Lysander Spooner, who have sort of carried the torch forward. And I think it's important that people engage with those thinkers and be challenged by them and argue with them and sort of look towards the horizon rather than back towards the past.
Thanks for listening. This episode of Free Thoughts was produced by Tess Terrible and Evan Banks. To learn more, visit us at www.libertarianism.org.